Ever wonder what it's like to live alone, hidden in the woods, not speaking to a single soul for 30 years? Or wander the desert, uncover a hidden well, and dive to the bottom of the deepest waterhole for 2,000 miles? The Snap Judgment podcast takes you there with amazing stories told by the people who lived them. Each story is crafted with an original score, dropping you directly into someone else's world. It's raw, intimate. It's storytelling with a beat. Listen and subscribe to Snap Judgment wherever you get your podcasts, because someone's story might just change your life. Hi, Nocturnist listeners. Before today's episode, I want to share a very exciting announcement, which is that The Nocturnist is planning its first live performance since before the pandemic to take place in San Francisco in early June. The theme for the event is Together Again, which means we want to hear your stories about separations, rifts, reunifications, gatherings, and connections. Submit your story before Sunday, April 3rd on our website, thenocturnist.com/together again. That's thenocturnist.com/together again. Can't wait to see you at the show. Support for The Nocturnist comes from the California Medical Association.
At The Nocturnist, we are careful to ensure that all stories comply with healthcare privacy laws. Details may have been changed to ensure patient confidentiality. All views expressed are those of the person speaking and not their employer.
You're listening to The Nocturnist Conversations. I'm Emily Silverman. Today's guest is Jenny Chi. Jenny is the author of Focal Point, winner of the 2020 Steel Toe Books Poetry Award. Her writing has been published in the New York Times and the Atlantic. She's a 2022 to 2023 Brown Handler resident, and she's received support from Tin House and others. Born in Pennsylvania to Chinese immigrants, she grew up mostly in Las Vegas and now lives in San Francisco, where she completed her PhD in cancer biology. Currently, she's working on more essays and poems and translating her late mother's memoirs. Before I spoke with Jenny, I asked her to read Telomeres and a 2 a.m. Love Poem, one of the poems from her collection, Focal Point. Here's Jenny.
These are the only kind I'll write you when I should be reading about telomeres, how they guard the ends of chromosomes and wane with every breath we take, leaving fragments of ourselves behind as our cells grow and divide and become ever more vulnerable as we grow older. I have the sudden brilliant thought that the chromosomes in our heart cells must have the shortest telomeres of all. And I think how I can only admit that I might tolerate, /like/love you when my science becomes this bleary-eyed, delirious brain mush. These nights, I look at you sleeping and want to press my lips to your forehead, tug a corner of the sheet from beneath your arm, tuck myself in its place. Come morning, you'll be just a heavy arm slung across my stomach, too warm body curled around my spine. But now I think mad thoughts, like how maybe you could be an exception, and how maybe I could do this every night, and how maybe we could let our telomeres shorten together.
Thank you so much for that reading. It's so nice to have you here. You are the first poet that I've interviewed for the Nocturnist Conversation, so I'm so excited to talk about your collection and your process and poetry and science and all of the above.
Thank you, Emily. Yeah, I'm excited. And I'm excited to be the first poet you're talking to.
Before we get into the poetry side of things, tell us about your journey to the health sciences. I know that you have a PhD in cancer biology. How did you get interested in cancer, in research, and walk us through that process for you?
I mean, I guess like many children of immigrants, my parents wanted me to be a physician when I grew up, because that would be something pretty stable. And so I spent most of my life being pre-med. And in college, I found my way to research because I started working in a lab, and this lab actually did neuroscience research using zebrafish as a model organism. And this was at Vanderbilt University. So I started doing this mainly because I was pre-med. But as I continued, I found that I just really enjoyed the lab environment. And I enjoyed the sense of curiosity I felt in everyone who worked there. And that's really something that is similar to what drives a lot of poetry, I think, is just the sense of curiosity about the world and the mysteries of the universe. So yeah, that is how I stumbled my way into research and shifted gears from being pre-med to being on a research track. The reason I switched over into cancer biology was largely personal. My mother had been sick with lung cancer the entire time I was in college, and so that largely informed all of my life decisions at that time. And I was pretty young. I started college when I was 16. It's weird that we expect people to just make these big decisions about their lives at such a young age. My mother passed away at the very end of college, and that was what really pushed me into pursuing cancer biology rather than any other field that I might have been interested in.
I'm sorry about your mom. So I just wanted to say that it's clear from your poetry that you're really close. And so I just wanted to say that I'm sorry that you lost her.
Thank you.
There was something that you just said, which is that you really liked the lab environment. And some of our listeners may have spent time in a lab, but a lot of them probably haven't. Can you paint a picture? What is the lab environment? Like, you show up in the morning and walk in the room and like, what do you see? What's happening? And what do you like about it?
I guess I'll describe the lab environment as I knew it in college. We were in like a pretty brightly lit room, and it's almost like an open office where you have all these lab benches, and you walk in and you walk past a bunch of your colleagues and get to your desk and plan out your experiments for the day. It was a soothing routine in a way, particularly in that time where so much of my life was just very chaotic. And in my undergrad lab, I mentioned that we worked with zebrafish. The zebrafish were housed in the basement. And so whenever I went down into the basement to work with the animals, I would go down and it was this very warm room. Almost felt like being in a womb, I guess, in a sense. And once in college, I was just down in the zebrafish room doing stuff. And I came out and a bunch of people were outside in the lobby area. And I was like, what's going on? Why is everyone here? And it turned out there had been a tornado that went through, because this was in Nashville, and I hadn't noticed it at all because I was just like working in the zebrafish room.
You were in the calm womb.
Yes.
And the violent weather was all outside. You know, when I was in medical school, I spent a summer in a basic science lab. It was an ophthalmology lab looking at the retinas of chicken embryos. And I was really bad at basic science. My experiments rarely worked. But I do remember being surprised by the day-to-day work of science. I guess in my mind, I had thought of it as like a super glamorous thing where you're like uncovering the mysteries of the universe, as you said. And you kind of are uncovering the mysteries of the universe, but it's very repetitive and slow work. And it almost reminded me of cooking. I just remember there were all these different recipes for different things, and you would take your pipette and squirt different ingredients, and you had to do it in the right order. And then you would prepare your slides and then stick it in an oven, and then you would set a timer and it would bake. And it felt a lot like cooking to me. So I'm wondering if you found that as well and how those rhythms were for you as a college student.
I think that's such an apt description. I don't currently work in a lab anymore, but after so much lab, I can't bake anymore because it feels too much like lab. And like throughout grad school, I had a lot of friends who were really into baking. And I was like, how can you do more of this after being in lab all day? I think in college, when I first started working in a lab, it all felt so exciting and new. Ultimately, I did not stay in the lab because I did find that, as you said, the work can be quite repetitive and slow. After some time, I found that maybe it wasn't for me long term.
And what kind of work are you doing now?
Now, I am working in competitive intelligence in oncology still. Now I'm focused on tracking ovarian cancer clinical trial pipelines and putting together proprietary reports on what the treatment landscape looks like.
What is competitive intelligence?
I describe it as being similar to consulting, but primarily it involves, for me at least, keeping track of specific cancer types and new developments in treatment for those cancers. The reports are generally purchased by pharma companies, so it's helping various companies keep track of the landscape so they know how to strategize their own developments.
It's such an interesting term, competitive intelligence, and the world of cancer is so diverse. As we know, cancer is not a single disease. There are many different types of cancer. And I remember when I was in residency, some of the oncologists telling me that there's been a paradigm shift in cancer where it used to be like organ-based. So it's like lung cancer, pancreatic cancer, you know, melanoma. But now people are starting to group them less by organ and more by the science of how the cancers behave. In your work, how do you think about the landscape of cancer? What does it look like?
In grad school, I researched a very rare kind of pancreatic cancer, PNETs. But the idea behind my research was not that I was focused on PNETs for the sake of focusing on PNETs, but for the sake of this mechanism that was common both there and in other secretory tumors. There is definitely still a bit of a focus on thinking about cancers by organ, but then I do think we are definitely in research more focused on mechanism. And I think treatment is also moving in that direction. So I mentioned that I focus on ovarian cancer. There aren't too many non-chemo treatments for that. The big thing now is PARP inhibitors and focusing on the DNA damage response pathway. Beyond that, a lot of things have not been super successful in clinical trials yet. One of the big things that I was really interested going into grad school and a lot of my friends have worked on has been immunotherapy. And that has revolutionized treatment of a lot of different cancer types, but not ovarian cancer.
I would love to hear another poem from your collection. Why don't we hear The Plural of Us?
Okay. The Plural of Us. The end of an us is a death without dying. Such a waste, it seems, to discard the dreams I dared beside you. Turn familiar hearts stone, each to our own separate deaths. Waking, I remember your crooked laugh. Sitting in your car watching the ocean crash, shape itself against stone, shape the stone. Think of starfish and its regenerating limbs. Think of the plural limbs of an octopus, like the octopus that slithered from its tank to freedom, the plural octopuses, octopodes, octopi, with all their limbs reaching. Think how the Latin plural of us is I.
I love that poem. I just think it's so clever. And it touches on a lot of different themes, including loss and death and grief. And I don't know if this poem was written about your mother, but a lot of the poems in the collection were written about your mother. It's a really strong theme that carries through the entire collection. So tell us a little bit about your mother. What was she like?
She was very ambitious and vibrant. So an example of what I mean is that my mother lived through the Cultural Revolution in China, and that interrupted her childhood and education. And for people who don't know what that involved, because her father was a high school principal and they were therefore considered educated, there was a revolt against this educated class, and she was sent to the countryside to like work in a field and be re-educated. After years of that, she was able to start school again. She was in her 20s at that point, starting high school. And she had always been someone who loved reading and writing, and she really wanted to catch up and get back the life that had been taken from her. And so she went through all of the rest of her schooling in like half the time that it should have taken. Then she was a history teacher in China. And then she had to start over again when she moved to the U.S., immigrating with my father. She found it really difficult to get a job without having job experience in the U.S. They first settled in Pittsburgh, and she really wanted to still be a part of academia in some way because that was what she had just always loved. So she went somewhere at the University of Pittsburgh and knocked on every door to like try to get a job there because she didn't know how else to do it in this country. That led to her first job as actually a lab tech at the University of Pittsburgh in a diabetes lab, which I find interesting also given that I wound up in a lab studying peanuts, which is kind of the opposite of diabetes in a way.
So you've mentioned peanuts a couple times. For our audience who doesn't know what that acronym stands for, can you tell us?
Yeah, so peanuts, P-N-E-T, the plural of that, stands for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. These are tumors that arise from the endocrine hormone secreting cells of the pancreas. And so where diabetes is the elimination of these hormone secreting cells, the cancer is the opposite. And there is excess growth of these endocrine cells and therefore excess hormone secretion.
Got it. So you're working with a disease that's almost like the mirror image of the disease that your mom was working with in the lab.
Yeah.
In your bio, you say that you're in the process of translating your mother's memoirs. So did she write about her life? And is that what you're translating? And what is that process like?
So I mentioned that my mother had always loved reading and writing, and she had to put those on the back burner throughout her life in order to work in America and make a better life for me. And so at the end of her life, she wrote two books. One was a memoir of her childhood during the Cultural Revolution and really was a book honoring her adoptive parents. And that was published in China before she died. So I'm glad she had the opportunity to see that. And the second book was a novel inspired by her immigration to the U.S. That novel, actually, it was never published. long story short, I had thought that this manuscript was just like lost forever. And then a couple years ago, when I visited my dad, I found a hard copy of this second manuscript, and it was all but the first 10 pages, which is fine. If I can get like 290 out of 300 pages, that's pretty good for something that I thought was just like lost forever. I mean, a lot of this process of translation initially has just been scanning things into like a workable document. I mean, my Chinese is definitely not as good as my English at this point. Even though it's technically my first language, I never did Chinese school or anything like that. So all of my language skills are based on my mom teaching me as best as she could around work and my schooling. And frankly, it's become even rustier since she died because I just lost that connection. It's taken me so long to even get started on this translation project, in part because it was just too painful throughout grad school. Part of it was the demands on my time of grad school and subsequently work. And part of it is just, it's emotionally difficult to like get into that space. And if I go into that space, it takes up a large chunk of my day. And so that can be sort of challenging. I think often these days of a line from a Camille Dungy poem where she says, "I try to write everything down to avoid the comforts of suppression." I've been thinking about that a lot because I think in our everyday lives, it is so easy to turn towards the comforts of suppression and not think about these hard things.
That makes a lot of sense. It reminds me of when I would spend long stretches of time working in the hospital, and then I would have a long stretch of time off, and I would suddenly start to feel all these things in my body, like a tightness in my throat. Mm-hmm. And then I realized like it was always there, but when I was working, I was just numbing out and not feeling it. And then it was only after I left the hospital that I came back into my body and I was no longer suppressing the discomfort. I can attest that feeling it is unpleasant. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like the only way out is through. And so you have to feel it in order to come out the other side more healthy and more whole.
Definitely.
Is it the memoirs that you're translating or the novel or both?
Both. I'm kind of just like bouncing back and forth right now. More to come on that front, but it's in the very early stages right now.
Well, I can't wait to hear how that project progresses.
Thank you. I'm kind of curious, if you don't mind my asking, what your process is now for dealing with these uncomfortable emotions that come up. Like if you still find that you have to just numb out while you're working and then process it later, or if you found a way to not numb out.
It's such a good question. In some ways, it's the million-dollar question. For me, writing has always been a huge part of that. Writing and storytelling and filtering reality through the arts and then looking at it and understanding it in that way. For a lot of people, it's exercise, understanding the value of movement, even if it's very gentle movement like yoga or walking or Tai Chi is something that I've tried a little bit and been really impressed by how just a little bit of intentional movement can work things through the subconscious.
Yeah, definitely. I turned to exercise a lot after my mom passed during grad school. I got really into it. I mean, part of it was also just that I had not been an athletic child at all. So it was like, well, I guess I am in this new world now. I want to try new things. And so I got really into that, like pretty into yoga. After I was vaccinated, I also started doing an acrobatics class kind of nearby, and that's been really fun and rewarding. I'm terrible at it. Like, I don't want people to get the wrong impression and think that I'm like athletic now. Like, but it's been nice to see that progress week after week, and kind of nice as an adult to do something that I'm just bad at and be okay with being bad at it. No, no. How many times in adulthood do we get to do that?
Yeah, I hear that for sure. In science and medicine, a lot of us are high achievers, or another way to put it is that we suffer from bad achievement-itis. And I have received the advice from professionals that I should tap into the joy of failure and try things that I'm bad at and be bad at them and laugh and enjoy that. And then once I start to get good at it, move on. Move on to a different activity so that you don't lose that being bad, because it's something that can be really uncomfortable. But if you can find the joy in it, it can actually be really healing. Talked a little bit about exercise and ways of working through difficult emotional situations, like, for example, this process of translating your mother's written work. But what we haven't talked about is your process of creating poetry. It's such a specific artistic medium, very different from writing nonfiction or writing fiction. In some ways, it is the most primal form of writing. And I would love to hear from Jenny, the poet. How do you create a poem?
I love what you said about how poetry is the most primal form of writing, because I totally agree with that. And I've often said that part of the reason that was my outlet and that was what came out of my grief first is because of that primal nature and because of the emotional urgency of poems that is not quite in other forms. And because of that, I can't really say I have like a strict process for writing a poem. Often the poems that end up being what I consider finished at some point come out of me ruminating on a phrase or an image, and I might think about something that I'm obsessing over for like months and months before it even turns into a poem. But I think the importance of that is that it's just been like marinating. There are other times where I do try to have more of a disciplined writing practice and force myself to just like sit down and write. I've done morning pages on and off where like first thing in the morning, you just write 3 pages and that gets all of the verbal stuttering out. I wish I could say I really did this every single day, but it kind of goes on and off. And then throughout grad school, I did something every April, which is National Poetry Month. I just called it like a daily syllabic. And so every day I arbitrarily gave myself some kind of constraint, like gave myself a form, like a haiku or a tanka, or just an arbitrary number of syllables per line to stick with, and just wrote some sort of little poem thing. Very few of those actually turned into publishable poems, but it was just the practice of sitting down, forcing myself to get into that headspace every day. And so I enjoy like going through periods of doing things like that.
What is your revision process like, if you have one? Or do the poems just come out the way that they come out and there's minimal revision? How does that work?
That varies a lot. Some of the poems do come out basically finished, and those are really nice when it happens. There's some poems where it just takes time. Like one of the poems in this book, I wrote a draft like 10 years ago, and I just set it down. I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know how to change it, only that it didn't feel finished. And then years later, I came back to it. And I did also send it to a friend for some feedback. And sometimes the feedback is just shift your perspective a little on this entire poem. And sometimes it's like, maybe cut these few extra words. And so I think my own revision process also varies between those extremes.
Well, you have created a beautiful body of work here with Focal Point, and I have so much enjoyed chatting with you about science and family and wellness and poetry. We've covered a lot of ground. I would love to close out with one final reading, but before we do, is there anything else you'd like to share with the audience?
Related to a lot of what we've talked about, something that I have been thinking about a lot lately is that it's okay to be idle sometimes. Or rather, I'm trying to convince myself of this because it can be difficult. I think, like in science and medicine, these are not cultures of being idle, but it's really necessary to the creative process and to our mental health. And so I just want to say that, both for myself and like anyone else, that's okay.
I think that is a welcome message for our audience and certainly for me. So thank you for saying it. Can we close with a poem?
Yes, of course.
Let's close with the poem, When This Is All Over.
When this is all over, here is what I will miss. Running through the park, even when I hated it. Cursed my legs for their sourness. The heron walking into the pond, small white reflection emerging from the verdure, so lush it brushes the sky teal. Bees floating from poppy to lupine to cobweb thistle, tender hum and churn, like waves lapping the shore, like language, like love, so certain. How could it be any other way? Even the fog, that cool gray mist stalking the shoreline, feeding redwoods pale honey from a mercurial god, feasting on city lights in waning hours. And at the end, squinting into the bright ocean, once described by the Greeks as wine, because they didn't have words for the color blue, or there wasn't yet blue, or maybe they were drunk off its immensity.
I have been talking to Jenny Chi about her poetry collection, Focal Point. Jenny, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Emily. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. This episode of the Nocturnist Conversations was produced, edited, and mixed by John Oliver. Our executive producer is Ali Block, our chief operating officer is Rebecca Groves, and our administrative assistant is Carly Besser. Our original theme music was composed by Joseph Monroe, and any additional music comes from Blue Dot Sessions. The Nocturnist is made possible by the California Medical Association, a physician-led organization that works tirelessly to make sure that the doctor-patient relationship remains at the center of medicine. To learn more about the CMA, visit cmadocs.org. Our show is also made possible by donations from listeners like you. Thank you so much for supporting our work in storytelling. If you enjoy the show, please help others find us by giving us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. To contribute your voice to one of our upcoming projects or to make a donation, visit our website at thenocturnist.com. I'm your host, Emily Silverman. See you next time.